This week we have Parshat Bahalotcha. It's actually one of these parshiot that is so full of drama and episodes and interesting episodes. The challenge is perhaps not to see them as a bunch of independent episodes that take place, but rather to see the theme which is running through them. And then, of course, the other element is to see to what extent and how what happens over here impacts as we move forward. Because there really is something pivotal that takes place in this time. And the pivotal thing is that after, depending on how you want to count, you can count chronologically how much time it's taken, or you can count by how many books or parshiot it's taken. And that is that the Jews arrived at Har Sinai all the way back in Shemot, all the way back in chapter 19, and now they're taking their leave from Sinai, so therefore they've been here for a good part, you know, half of Shemot, all of Vayikra, beginning of Bamidbar, and now they're finally going to take leave from Sinai. So that's really the pivotal change that takes place, is that they're starting on their way, and there are going to be certain elements that are going to take place as they start to travel, which are going to be so important. And one of the things which really I want to try to identify, I'm going to call this as some type of a subtext to what's taking place, is the way I'll phrase it, at least for right now, is the question of holiness and the attitude of the people toward holiness. I'll say a little bit more about this as we move on, but first I want to do something which is a little introductory to that. But again, I'm doing that in order to address this question about how the people feel towards holiness. And what we have is in chapter 9, Perek Tet, which is before they take their leave, we're told, God says to Moshe, V'deber Hashem Moshe, B'midbar Sinai, B'shana Hashenit, L'tzeitam Yer Tetzrayim, B'chodesh HaRishon Limor. So it is the second year, it is the first month, one whole year has gone by at this point since Shemot Perek Yud Bet, when God says, HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, which is really in a certain sense the beginning of the end, the beginning of leaving Egypt, and maybe it's also the beginning of much more than that, because that really establishes the Jewish calendar, which to a certain extent establishes us as a people, certainly in terms of our ability of celebrating holidays and so forth. So now 1 year has gone by since that point. V'yasu b'nei Yisrael ato Pasach b'mo'ado. And now we're told, which we were already hinted back at that point in Shemot Yud Bet, that Pesach, the Korban Pesach, and again, just to remind us, the word Pesach, which today, and from the time of the Mishnah, has already meant the idea of the holiday, which is for 7 days, biblically, Pesach only means the Korban Pesach, and the 7 day holiday is always referred to as Chag HaMatzot. So over here it says you're going to do the Pesach B'moado, so as I said, this is a biblical text, so therefore what it's saying is that just like we were told before we left Egypt, that Pesach, the Korban, and the celebration, is not just something which was done as part of the leaving of Egypt, and it was in context, but rather it's something which the Jews are going to do moving on a yearly basis. So Pesach is something which is going to be celebrated every year. So now we're coming to the first anniversary of the Pesach that was commemorated or celebrated as we left Egypt. So now we'll have a commemoration of that Korban Pesach. So do the Pesach b'mo'ado in its proper time. Of course, how do you establish proper time? By having the calendar, and this is the 1 year anniversary of the calendar. Rabasa yom bechodesh hazeh, bein arbaim, tasu oto b'mo'ado k'chol chukotav, uv'chol mishpotav tasu oto. You're going to do it on that date, on the 14th, according to all of its rules and all of its details and so on. V'idbir Moshe b'nei Yisrael lasoto Pesach, and Moshe then told the Jewish people that we are going to do the Korban Pesach again. And they did it in the desert in the proper way as they were instructed. And then comes what we have bolded over here in our sources. However, there were some people who were suffering from some type of impurity. We're told the impurity over here is connected to being in contact with the dead. And because they had tum'ah, spiritual impurity, they were unable to participate in the korban on that day, and therefore they approached Moshe and Aaron on that day. We're suffering from tum'ah, from spiritual impurity. Lama nigra levilti korban Hashem b'moado b'toch b'nei Israel. So why should we be unable to be involved in the bringing of this offering in its proper time with the rest of the Jewish people? And I, at this point, have a very simple question that I want to pose. Is their request or their interest in this, is it fundamentally something which is religious, or is it fundamentally something which is more nationalistic or social? Which means, is it that, hold it, there's a party going on, why aren't we invited, why can't we participate? And let's admit it, Pesach Seder is like a wonderful thing which brings families together throughout history, and we invite relatives even if they don't necessarily keep all of the other laws of Judaism. There is this other national, social aspect of Pesach, and maybe it's always been that way. So my question again is, because I told you, the background that I'm looking for is the attitude of the people towards holiness. Is the idea of Pesach Sheni, and there's no question that some people will frame it this way, is the request for another opportunity to do the Korban Pesach, we'll be a little bit more careful. They're asking, why can't we participate? They didn't ask for another opportunity. Why can't we participate? Is this something which is coming from religious yearning that they want to relate to God, celebrate leaving Egypt? Or is this something which emanates from them wanting to be part of the Jewish people, which I would call more national? If you don't like my distinction, then I apologize. But you note the three words that really catch my attention, and that is the B'toch B'nai Yisrael. And, with the Jewish people. So wait here and let's see what God has to say regarding your situation. The Sforno frames the question as, in source 2, May achush tum atolad var mitzvah lamet yagored avera, which is very interesting, because I need to explain a little bit more. Generally, we can divide our commandments, and there's lots of ways to divide them, but generally we can divide them into positive and to negative. Breaking a negative commandment has consequences, sometimes very severe consequences. The lack of fulfillment of a positive commandment generally has very, very little, if any, consequences. You missed an opportunity. I don't want to go into any more detail than that, but somebody who didn't do a positive commandment missed an opportunity. That's all that it is. There's two exceptions to this, which are seen as being much more severe. How do I judge what is severe? By introducing punishment. Punishment is called karet. Karet means cut off from the Jewish people. One positive commandment which results in karet is not performing a circumcision. That means in a certain sense you're not part of the people. The only other positive commandment which lack of fulfillment results in punishment of karet, again, this is done purposely and so on, and there are numerous conditions to this, is somebody who does not bring the Korban Pesach. So over here, the way the Sforno is framing it, if we are doing a mitzvah, which means they were involved in taking care of some corpse or bringing the corpse, the whole question in the Talmud is, which corpse are we talking about? Just for argument's sake, let's have a theory of conservation of corpses. We know that they carried Yosef out of Egypt, so let's say that it's Yosef. So therefore, we're fulfilling a promise that the Jewish people had to Yosef and taking Yosef out of Egypt and bringing him to the land of Israel. So why should we suffer and be punished? So listen again the way the Sforno puts it. So they really understand, according to the way he's putting it, that the lack of being involved, the lack of bringing the Korban Pesach, is actually tantamount to a sin. Do they really think that the punishment will be that severe, one of karet, that I can't say, but he is framing it. If we're doing something good, why should we be rewarded, as it were, with something bad? The Chizkuni phrases it like this, Lama ina nu rishaim lachol kadshim bitum'a, harei eshtakadacha nu apesach b'mitzrayim afilo bitum'a. So the way that the Chizkuni puts it, first I'm going to tell you their logic, and then I'm going to tell you why we're reading it. Their logic is that last year in Egypt, when we brought the Korban Pesach, everybody was tameh. Everybody had this ritual impurity. So, and nonetheless brought the Korban Pesach. So now, what's changed? Well, what's changed is we stood by Mount Sinai, we learned all kinds of laws, we learned Sefer Vayikra, we know about the concept of Tuma, and at this point now we realize that somebody who is Tamei is not allowed to eat a Korban, to eat from something which is holy. So therefore, they're saying, but last year we did it, why can't we do it now? Now, that's the logic. But the focus of the point over here would actually be not necessarily the B'toch B'nei Yisrael, we want to celebrate with the rest of the people, but rather it sounds much more like we're looking for holiness. We also want to eat the Korban Pesach. If you look at the Kli Yakar, he notes that there are certain principles that the Korban Pesach can be brought and partaken of in Tumah, but that's only if the entire Tzibur is Tameh. If the whole Tzibur is Tameh, then the Korban Pesach Bura, which may actually answer or respond to the Chizkuni's point. He says, Ke'ach she'shem'u lashon v'mo'ado amru l'minigra min ha'tzibur. So now, again, the Kli Yakar seems to be focusing on that other side of it, not that they want to eat the Korban per se, but rather it sounds like why should we be separated from the people? And uba tshuva, ish dafke ish nidche v'lo tzibur. That means that an individual whose Tamei is pushed aside, but not a Tzibor. Tzibor is never pushed aside. So again, it sounds as if, I'll say it one more time, you may not like my distinction, but it seems to me that there's two ways of understanding it. Is this an expression of the individuals who can't be involved, that they want the holiness as well? Or is this an expression of the individuals involved, why are we cut out from the people? Which means, is it a religious argument, or is it more of a nationalist argument? If you look at Rav Hirsch, he writes in Source 5, "V'hu kor v'toch b'nei Yisrael, hu korban tzibur, v'im chelek manat tzibur." So again, he's arguing this is not an individual korban, it's a korban of the whole community. We're part of the community, and I'll say it again, that pushes us towards one side of the argument. The Netziv has an interesting technical point, and this will wrap up this first section for us. And he says that it's true that a korban could be brought if in a situation of tumah. He goes, but it can't be eaten when it's situation of tumah. And the main thing about the korban Pesach is obviously the eating of the korban Pesach. Although one can counter, if somebody was involved, if somebody brought the korban Pesach, and then a situation arose that they couldn't eat it, they fulfilled the mitzvah of korban Pesach. So, if I'm not mistaken. It's a little hard for me to argue with the Netziv, but I'll just say I'm a little surprised because I think that I'm correct in what I just now said, that even if somebody was involved in a group that brought it and then subsequently something happened that they can't eat it, they nonetheless fulfilled their as long as at the time it was brought, it was capable of them to eat it. Even if something else happened, it's actually the bringing of the korban, which is the point. It could be he's getting very technical, but bringing a korban that you can't possibly eat may not then be included in it. So, as I said, it gets technical, but I'll say it again. This is really the question in my mind. Are we dealing with a group of people who have a deep desire for holiness or a deep desire to be part of the people? Full stop. Second, even if they are seeking holiness, does this group then represent, is it a good representation of the people? Maybe it's a very poor representation. Maybe these are the people who volunteered to be carrying Yosef's remains. Maybe that itself tells you about these people. These people are involved in mitzvot, involved in holiness, and maybe therefore they're a very poor representation of the larger community. Nonetheless, I'm asking, because I'll say it again, what I'm interested today is to try to take the temperature and the sense of understanding where the people are at in terms of their desire for holiness. And I think that once we see that as the issue, we'll be able to go through all kinds of parts of this parsha. Source number 7, V'yihi b'shana ha'shinit, b'chodesh ha'shini, b'esrim b'chodesh. Now we've moved up another month and 20 days. And now na'ale hanan me'al mishkan ha'idut. And now the cloud finally lifts. So again, they arrived at Sinai, in Book of Shemot in chapter 19, and over here in chapter 10 of Bamidbar, the cloud lifts and it's time to start traveling. It travels, they get to a particular place. Now, this traveling is actually discussed in the Talmud. It's discussed among the commentaries. And let's put it like this. The rabbis generally see that the leaving of Sinai was done in the wrong type of way. Give me a couple of minutes, I'm going to come back to that. Then we have this short conversation. Moshe turns to Chovev ben Reuel, Hamidyani, Chotein Moshe, most likely another name for his father-in-law, and he says, Nosim anachnu ala makom asher amar Hashem. Oto etein lachem. L'chayitanu v'itavnu lach. K'Hashem diber tov al Yisrael. Moshe is focusing on the destination of where they're supposed to be going to once they have left Sinai. We're going to the land of Israel. And he turns to Chovev and he says, come join us. Now, he, of course, is from Midian. V'yom elav lo elech ki im al tziv elamadati elech. So you have Chovev then representing something which is very interesting. And again, maybe one individual, but maybe he captures something which is larger, which is part of what I want to try to figure out. And essentially what he says is, I have no interest in going to the lands of Israel. I want to go home. Now, again, is he not interested in holiness, or is he not part of this people? I can start playing that same game again, which maybe seems very unnatural to you, but that's the question. Why does he not want to go to Israel? So you can say, because your people are not my people, right? We'll go back to the story of Ruth, right? Ruth and Naomi, your people are not my people, right? You go to your land, I'm going back to my land, I'm not continuing with you. Nonetheless, Moshe turned to him and said, no, come with us, because this is where you should be. This is, you know what, this is the place that God has chosen. This is the place where holiness is. So what you have over here is really Moshe addressing the issue of holiness, and what you have over here is Chovev either not interested in holiness or not feeling part of the people and wanting to go back to his people. And now my question is this simply a discussion between two people, or does the sentiment of, or the attitude of Chovev perhaps resonate with some other people also? Which means leaving Sinai now means to Moshe that we're going to Israel. And it's at this point that he says, I'm just not interested. Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Vayisumi Har Hashem Derech Shloshet Yamim. And they travel from Sinai for 3 days. So we have a 3-day journey. Brit Hashem, right? Va'aron Brit Hashem Nosei Lefneim Derech Shloshet Yamim Latur Lehem Menucha. And it actually sounds quite miraculous and supernatural. You have the ark leading the way. V'anan Hashem Aleim Yoma B'nisa Min HaMachaneh, and divine protection from the Anan. It's at that point, by the way, that we have our two verses, which I've spoken about so many times, so I'm not going to talk about today. The two verses with the two in verse Nun, V'hi Ben Tzora Aron and B'nucho Yomar. That's where those are placed, even though there's at least one voice in Chazal that says, no, that's not really the place. It should have been a little bit earlier. It should have actually been before they leave Har Hashem. But as I said, that's one of the opinions. The next we find is what I like to call chapter 11, because it's chapter 11. And this is where we find spiritual bankruptcy of the people. V'yi'am ki mit'onenim rabba iznei Hashem. And the people start to complain, and it's very bad in the way that God hears it. V'yishma Hashem, God hears. V'yichar apo, and God is angered with them. V'tiv arbam ish Hashem v'tocha b'kze ha'machaneh. And the fire of God goes and to the katze of the machaneh. There will be some debate what the word katze means, because katze is the edge, but when it's the edge, it could be one of two edges. It could be the highest edge or it could be the lowest edge, as we'll see some of the commentaries say. It then says, V'yikrashim ha'makom ahu tav'era, ki barabam eish Hashem. The place is called Tav'era, burning, because this is where the fire of God burnt. Then in Pasuk Dalet, we're told either another episode, which would be really bad that we go from one to the other and so on, or this is an explanation of the first episode. Vasafsuf asher b'kabo hatadu ta'ava. And the, I don't know how to translate asafsuf, I'll translate them because we want to try to go for some alliteration, the riffraff among them, asafsuf among them, hitavu ta'ava. Now, ta'ava is not a wonderful word. There's a very big difference between ahava and tahava, between ratzon and ta'ava. Ta'ava means, or it could be translated as lust. Hitavu ta'ava, that they lusted lust. Now, that already, we should know, is not going to be good. We have all the way back in the Garden of Eden, where Eve, you know, also has the same word which is used when she looks at the tree. V'yashuvu v'yivku gam v'nei Yisrael. So it starts, see, this is what's interesting. You say the katzei machane, it starts with those at the outer end of the camp, and then it impacts the people in the center of the camp. which is at least one reason to suspect that we're dealing with one episode and not two. Vayomru mi yachlenu basar, who's going to give us meat? Now, there's going to be some debate whether they're really talking about meat or not, but let's just say right now that they have this desire for meat. Zacharnu et adaga, so they remember the fish, which is also a little funny. Who's going to give us meat? Because we have fond memories of fish. With all due respect, you know, one of the rules of life is you never order fish in a meat restaurant, right? And what's the connection over here between things? Remember the fish, ashenochab mitzrayim chinam, that we ate for free. I mean, again, was it really free? What does free mean over here? I mean, they were slaves. Does it mean that they went fishing and it was easily accessible? What exactly does free mean? And then the most bizarre verse in the Torah, et hakishuim v'et avtichim v'et hakatsir v'et habitzalim v'et hashumim. So they remember all of these things. Most of them are vegetables, so one does not begin to understand what it is that they're complaining about. And on top of all this, why are these particular things chosen? V'atanav shenu yivesha ein kol bilti ataman einenu. The only thing that we have is the man. And the word einenu is also a little bit awkward in this sentence. So let's just back down for a second. They have food. They're able to eat three meals a day or as many meals a day as they need to. It's not that they're lacking nutrition, and it's not that they're lacking sustenance, and it's not that they're going hungry. And the food that they're getting is food from heaven. They're getting heavenly food, which I can then say maybe even has this aspect of holiness to it. So is their rejection over here of the man simply a culinary choice, or is this something which is much deeper? Which means and it's also funny. We used to eat for free, yeah? How's your man bill? Like, right? How much, right? Remember the days you used to go to Makola, just put it on the bill, sign it up, and we'll pay you at some point? Do they have a man bill that they have to pay that God has been, they're getting man for free. So this complaint of, we used to get fish for free, now you're getting man. Now, this is going to be far more complicated, especially to those who will claim, and this is, you know, back to the Midrash, that the man tasted like anything you wanted. So if the man tastes like anything you wanted, so what exactly are they lacking? I mean, these people are having waffles and ice cream for breakfast, right? And not only that, it's most likely nutritious because it's heavenly food. So you don't have to deal with the high blood pressure or the cholesterol or all kinds of other potential problems. So this is very, very interesting. And on top of all of this, there's another issue. If they really wanted to eat meat, they could have eaten meat. What kind of meat could they have eaten? They could have brought a korban. So you bring a korban shlamim, and then you can eat meat. Don't argue with me. During the midbar, they were allowed to bring korbanos. So therefore, they could have brought a korban. They could have eaten meat. But apparently, what they're not interested is things which are holy, which means I'm making an argument over here, which you don't like, then argue with me. And that is that it seems to be very much that there is something against holiness, which seems to be the problem. On top of all that, I have another question, which probably is stronger than all of my other points. And that is, they just left Sinai, they traveled for 3 days. We're told later on in Devarim that the distance between Sinai and Eretz Yisrael is 11 days, which means even if they got lost if they got lost the first 3 days and went the wrong way, so we're still 14 days. I mean, think about it. This is 11 days. This is 2 weeks. This is a week. This is maybe 11 minus 7. Maybe it'll take off Shabbos. You can take off Friday. How much time is involved in all of this until they go to Eretz Yisrael? By the way, when we get to Eretz Yisrael, if you remember this great verse, it says when they get there and they go to war, they're allowed to eat all of the pork chops which they find inside the homes when they go. It was a special one-time rule. So therefore, you want to eat meat, you want to eat pork. Good. Go to Israel, go to war, capture whatever you capture, then you can eat anything which is there, and then once you're there, then you will start to live normal lives. You're not going to have the man, you're not going to have anything. So what in the world is going on over here? Again, the timing of all this seems to be so bizarre. Yes, they leave Sinai, they travel for 3 days, and now there is this, you know, total breakdown. And by the way, notice what will happen afterwards. God is going to actually hold them here for 30 days and feed them as much as they want for 30 days and give them other things. Don't you realize that getting what they want for 30 days is actually silly? I'm not saying that God is silly. I'm saying that them entering into this entire quagmire is silly. because they could have already achieved a completely different time of life within a much shorter amount of time, which therefore causes me to question what in the world is taking place over here in terms of either these two episodes or this one episode, which is now explained a little bit further. It tells us a little bit what the man was like and how they would eat it. It says, "Vasuoto ugot vaya ta'amo kitam lishad hashamen." Whatever in the world that means. I'm going to point something out which you'll think is completely unnecessary. But the word shad also means breast, which, again, you'll say to me, well, why am I pointing that out? Well, I'm pointing it out because of what's going to happen right afterwards. It also comes back down to the point of how one is fed. You know, the earliest way that somebody eats is when the child is breastfed from the mother. And over here, it talks about the man in such a way of, again, coming from God and God taking care of us. And v'yishma Moshe ta'am, bocheh l'mishpachotav. Now that's something that also gets their attention. What does l'mishpachotav mean? Ish l'petach o'alo. Each one is crying by their tents. V'yicharef Hashem ha'od. And God was exceedingly upset with this. Uve'eni Moshe ra, which is very ominous. Because normally, even though things are bad, Moshe then comes to the defense. V'yoma Moshe l'Hashem, l'ma harayot al avdecha. Like, why do you make my life so difficult? Why don't you like me at all? The sumut masakol amazalai, to put this whole burden, these people upon me. Anochi horiti et kol amazeh, imanochi elditihu, which goes back to this issue of the mother. Am I the one who carried them? Am I the one who gave birth to them? Ki tomar elai sa'ei b'chikach asher yisaha omein et hayonek. Right, and you tell me to carry them the way that the nursemaid would carry the child who's suckling, which is actually very interesting because Moshe's mother was both his nursemaid, hired and paid for it, and also his mother. And now over here, Moshe is going, in a sense, back to that memory or to that description and saying, am I the one who really gave birth to this people? Am I the one who have to nurse them? And that's the reason, actually, why I pointed out the issue of the possible concept of the breast beforehand. We're not going to do it today. But I have pointed out in the past that there have commentaries that later will note that Eldad and Medad, that the word Dad is in both of their names, which also has a connotation of nipple or, and again, of breast and of suckling, which they absolutely bring into the story, which maybe sounds quite bizarre to some of us, but it's just very interesting also in terms of the description of prophecy, which is also described as peh al peh and so on. But we'll, as I said, we'll pause with that. But Moshe then says, where do I have meat to give these people? And they're crying and they're acting, in a sense, like such children. Now, all this is going to help us to get someplace. Moshe complained, I can't do this by myself. And God's response is, okay, I'll help you. And it's at this point that he brings in 70 people, and these 70 people prophesize. And again, the last two in the camp are Eldad and Medad. And then people complain that Eldad and Medad are prophesizing as well. And Moshe's response at the end is, V'yomu lo Moshe ha-makaneata li'yimiten ki kol am nevi'im ki ten Hashem et rucho aleihem. And part of the reason why this is so important, because again, there's two ways of reading this. One way of reading it is that Moshe is looking at prophecy in terms of his own personal space. It's what he owns. It's his dominion. The other way of saying is that Moshe desires for incredible holiness upon the entire people. And I'll say it again, the issue over here may very well be holiness. And if the issue is holiness, we're going to go back again. And we noted Pesach Sheni. We kind of noted leaving Mount Sinai, but not enough. We noted this idea of Chavav not wanting to join as we continue. We noted the people have this total breakdown in terms of food, which seems bizarre given the timing of what's taking place, because they should be not staying there all that long. So give me a couple seconds. And finally, we have at the end, just in terms of a rejection of holiness, we have a very unexpected rejection of holiness, and that is source number 9. And it says, "Harak ach b'Moshe diber Hashem lo gam banu diber v'ishma Hashem v'ish Moshe anav ma'od," which is essentially a rejection of the special status of Moshe. And God's response is, "There's a special status of Moshe." So therefore, they don't seem to see it. And then, almost with poetic justice, she then develops a type of tumah tzara'id, which sends her out of the camp. So we go back to this, and Aaron says she's as if that she's dead. right? Which is very interesting just in terms of our Pesach Sheni, of people feeling that they're outside of the camp and separated because of the sense of Tum'ah. And now we have Miriam having this Tum'ah and being outside of the camp. But at least in this sense, we hear and we understand that the camp is going to end up waiting for her as we continue to move on. As far as what the people know or they don't know, you know, Rashi in chapter 24, Perek of Dalet, says that Moshe teaches the people all of Sefer Bereshit and all of the Torah up to Matan Torah. Okay, that's what Rashi says. I would argue that there is probably one exception, at least one exception, that Moshe didn't teach them, that's written earlier. And that is in source number 10. This is back when the Mun was first introduced. It says, sort of like a throwaway verse, "Uvnei Yisrael achlu ataman 40 shana ad bom la'eretz noshavet," and the people ate man for 40 years. Did Moshe really teach the people that before Matan Torah? Oh yeah, by the way, you're going to be in the desert for 40 years. So there you go, what do the people know? If that's the case, then, you know, all bets are off. But as I said, I find it very hard to believe, and it sounds much more that that's something which God tells Moshe to write at the end of the 40 years, to put it at that particular point. But what do the people know, or what do they believe? So I think that that's part of what we need to try to figure out. When it comes to the Mun, we're going to find some other things which are interesting going from the Midrash to the commentaries. In source 11, the Midrash Agadah will say, when they were complaining, what were they really complaining about? When they said, "Adagim chinam," and they ate free, "Elamahu chinam mina arayot." They said, no, they're really talking about, you know, one of the blessings of fertility is a blessing of fish. And they're saying is what really troubled them is the laws of personal status in terms of all kinds of relationships which are now not allowed. And that was they cried by the tents. And it asks then, but the Mun would taste like anything. Why would it not taste like these things that were mentioned in the verse? All of these things are difficult for a woman who gives birth, who's nursing. What an interesting comment. See, if I would have read this by itself before, you would have just looked at me and said, where is this coming from? Why are they mentioning this? But now you realize that there really was this subtext, again, moving on, in terms of the nurturing aspect of the Mun. And essentially what God is doing is that God is nursing us and giving us food for free and taking care of us. And therefore Moshe's response is, now they want something else. Who am I, you know, in a sense, to take that place? In source 12, so this is actually fascinating in terms of food. Restaurants, food, and so on. So I'll say a couple of things. I have to get some people upset with me now. We'll talk about food. One is, I'll almost never take a recommendation from somebody British about a restaurant. You're laughing. Why? Because generally, they're less interested in the food and more interested in everything else. In the ambiance, in the what kind of tablecloth, and in what kind of everything else other than the food itself. Now, there are other people who would be very interested in the presentation and what it looks like, and some people just focus on the taste. What does it taste like? Now, there's no question in my mind that what food looks like impacts the enjoyment that people have. I believe that social media is created in order to create good vibes, and they're very, very often, I'll put up on Facebook or on other places in social media, I'll put up things which I or Naomi made for Shabbos, and I actually have a huge following in terms of people who, like, they wait all week. I get complaints. If I don't put something up 1 week, I get complaints from all kinds of people. And people don't respond. Say, oh yeah, I saw the pictures. Now, part of the issue is that the pictures look really good. If you want, I'm happy to do, maybe I should do an art display one day of all the pictures of food. But the pictures look really good. And once the pictures look really good, then, wow, that looks like it tastes great. Well, that's fascinating that something looks like it tastes great. It made just look good and that tastes great as well. But it's part of the eating experience. That's what this midrash is expressing over here, is that the Mun tasted like anything, but it always looked like Mun. So therefore, they were missing this visual aspect of the experience of eating, and that's what they're complaining about. So as I said, I find this fascinating because it expresses that the food itself impacts other senses, not just the taste buds, but it also the visual experience. And he says, and that shenemar ein kol buti yataman einenu, and that's why the eyes are stressed over here. Rashi, explaining about this, kimit onenin ein matenu elaloshon alila. Mit onenin means that they are making something up. There's not something real to complain about. Mivakshim alila heich lefrosh meacharei makom. They were looking for a reason to rebel against God, and that's really quite disturbing. And Rashi continues and says, halfway through, Rabbi Bein Bazne Hashem, it says, Shem tkavim shetavo bezna vayaknit. They wanted to complain. Amr, oy lanu kama lubatnu bederech hazeh, shlosha yamim shlo nachnu mi'inu hederech. How difficult our travels were for 3 days already. Okay, we know it's going to be for 40 years. 3 days already. This is so, so bad. And, you know, you hear somebody complain it like that. You say, like what? By the way, really very childish type of complaint. B'kitzei ha-machaneh, Rashi says, b'muktzin shemem, l'shvilut, b'shiflut. It means the lowest ones, elu eirvav. Shemem v'nasya omer, b'kitzinim shemem, v'gdolim. So again, the katzeh could have been one side or the other. And Rashi covers his bets over here, and he presents those who say either one of them. This idea that certain things were difficult for people who nurse, if you thought that was so unique to that midrash, so now you should all feel bad about yourselves, because Rashi quotes it. Mnei sheim kashim leminikot. These kinds of things were difficult for those who nurse, and look at that, lo and behold, it was staring then at Rashi. Omim li'isha al techli shumu batzel b'nei tinok. They tell women who are nursing, don't eat garlic, don't eat onions, because that's going to hurt the quality of the breast milk. B'chor shor, v'yi kimit onanim, ke onanim al met. We're talking about people who are like mourning for the dead, which in a certain sense, again, in a certain sense, takes us back to Pesach Sheni, those taking care of the dead, and it brings us back to the description of the Tzara'at of Miriam, where she's like she's dead. So that also becomes very interesting that it makes its way over here. That is, by the way, from the Midrash. The Bechor Shor did not make that up. But then he finally tells us what's going on. What bothered them is you go back to leaving Sinai. You're leaving Sinai, and you're on the way to the land of Israel. So, I mean, when they left Egypt, what was the destination? Yeah, we told Paro we're going to serve God for 3 days in the desert. Yes, we told him that. But all along the way, we had always thought that the destination is to go to the land of Israel. It's true. By the burning bush, Moshe is told both destinations. Moshe is told, you'll take the people out, you'll lead them out, you're going to go to the land of Israel. And Moshe is also told, you come and serve God on this mountain. Okay, so we serve God on the mountain, which, by the way, itself should have taken a minimum amount of time. Arguably, that should have only taken 3 days, and so on. Which means what we constantly find is that the amount of time which this whole process is taking keeps growing and growing and growing. It's like the national debt, right? Every time you turn around, there's more time and there's more time and there's more time, which itself, by the way, could be very frustrating. But we finally left Mount Sinai, and now we know exactly where we're going. And what the Bechor Shor is calling them out on is that's really bad, because they're supposed to go to the land of Israel, and now they're frightened. Now, why should they be frightened? It's not that clear. But we now understand something else, that the leaving of Har Sinai, and then next week's Parsha, Parsha Tshlach, when they say, oh, let's send them Meraglim, is not disconnected, or the other way around, is that this idea that we need to know what's going on, this fear which is within them, this anxiety which is there, it's already expressed back over here when they're talking about the food, and in a sense it's saying it's a made-up complaint. The Ramban says, the Ramban is actually fascinating, because the Ramban, to a certain extent, ignores everything that I've said. And of course, I'm troubled by why he would do that or how he can do that. What do I mean by that? He's ignoring the time frame. He's ignoring, oh yeah, we're supposed to go to the land of Israel. It's as if that the Ramban is reading this as a given. Yeah, they're supposed to be there for 40 years. It's as if that verse about the 40 years is something which is already in his mind. Again, I'm overstating this, but when you read the Ramban in 15... V'nachon be'enai, ki kasher nitrach kumi har Sinai, again, that's the key. When they left Sinai, Shekarov li yishuv ubo betoch hamidbar hagadol v'narah b'masar rishon. When they come to this terrible, frightening desert, and this is their first, you know, journey, mitzdarim batzon lomer man naseh ve'ech nechiyah b'midbar hazeh u'man ochel u'man nishteh. What are we going to eat? I'm going to go back and say, what are you talking about? What are you going to eat? It's just a short trip. So he can counter and say that, no, it's still 11 days. It's still you need supplies. But the Ramban sounds very much like he's saying, what are we going to eat? He doesn't use the word 40 years. But it very much sounds like that's what the anxiety is. Oh, what are we going to do for 40 years? To which my response is like, so what are you talking about? And then he comes back to another point. Their kimit onanim, which really now we've seen means, in a sense, mourning. And he says, "Ve'arabin Hashem," and it's bad in God's eyes. This is like 2/3 of the way down in the Ramban. Shiolim lelechet acharav b'simcha uvetov levav merov kol tova shenatan lahem. So those of you who remember the verse in later on in Devarim, that why do all these bad things happen to you? Because you don't serve God. B'simcha uvetov lev merov kol. The Ramban just used that verse over here. Is that instead of having joy that God is taking care of. Now, just remember the description we've had till now. The Aron is going in front. The cloud is on top. The man is coming down. God is taking care of everything. Where is this fear from? Which means, where is this anxiety? Why are these complaints? Instead, there should be the sense of total joy and total happiness. Now, the Ramban, which I didn't bring here, which is a little bit before this, the Ramban goes earlier when he speaks about them leaving Har Sinai. He quotes this teaching, which is cited sometimes as being in a midrash. It's actually found in the Yerushalmi. And it says that one of the problems was how they left Sinai. They left Sinai, in the description of the midrashes, or the Yerushalmi, is they left Sinai like children running away from school. And the Ramban, and there's various ways of playing that, or framing that, or explaining that. And the Ramban says they were afraid they were going to get homework. Really, he says, they're afraid they're going to get more laws. Which means, in the Ramban's mind, there's like a kind of a bait and switch. And no, he does not use that phrase. They get their, okay, 10 commandments. Very soon the 10 commandments become 20 and 30 and 40 and 50. I don't know what the count is by this point. We're up to, you want to call it 613 and counting. And, you know, every day we stay there, we start learning more and more obligations and more things that we can't do. And therefore, when it's as if, again, teacher's in the middle of teaching, the bell rings, and kids run out of class. So he says they run out with joy. Okay, now we have to be careful. They run out with joy, and here's really the issue. Do they run away from Sinai because there is this incredible anticipation of where they're going next? Or are they running away from Sinai because they're running away from holiness? Which means that, to my mind, is really the issue which is taking place over here. It is this question of holiness. So this whole description that Chazal have, that they run away like kids, and you have to ask yourself, where do they get that from, idea of kids? Well, that's what Moshe is describing. Moshe is saying, it's like I'm holding these little kids, I'm taking care of little kids. Moshe turns them into infants in his description, or for that matter, the description that is given over here is one of little kids, and it goes back to the nursing, and it goes back to taking care of people. So therefore, of course, the Midrash is going to describe them as little kids running away from school, because that seems to be the maturity over here. And there's another point. If we read a little bit further, let's look at Reb Chaim Paltiel, again from the Balei Tosfot in Source 16, Kimit Olmanim, Mitzlonimal Shahayir HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ritzon Lichnisam La'aretz. Again, we saw this also Ek in the Choshor. Many of the Balei Tosfot go in this direction. They worried about everything, worried about the war, they're worried about the traveling, and they maybe what it really comes down to is worried about inadequacy. But look at the Paneach Raza, which says as follows. Kimit onanim, pirish, ka'onanim, people mourning, loshen aninut, shitablu al, shekadosh baruch hu yaretz lechnasam la'aretz Yisrael, mehira. So what's the whole problem? Swiftly, quickly, to go to Israel. And I asked you the question. They're supposed to swiftly and quickly go to the land of Israel. Why are they complaining? Because they don't want to swiftly and quickly go to the land of Israel. Which you realize his comment is absolutely, again, I don't want to say correct, but absolutely addresses the issue which is taking place over here. The plan as of this moment, the itinerary as of this moment, is not to stay there for 40 years. Kipirish Rashi. Rashi already had pointed this out. Look at back in Source 13, in Vayichar Apo, around 5 lines, 6 lines down, Ani hayiti mitkaven l'tovatchem shetikansu la'aretz miyad. So again, Rashi sometimes a little downplays this. Yeah, but that's dramatic. Rashi said, supposed to go to the land of Israel immediately. So why are you crying? Why are you complaining? What is going on over here? So back to the Panei Achraza, because again, I think he adds one more element to this that we should be troubled with. But first, let me tell you what bothers me, and another thing bothers me, and then you'll see how he actually answers, how he directly answers it. Moshe feels very alone. Moshe feels very isolated. If we do go back to Parsha Yitro, we recall that Yitro gives Moshe some advice. He says, Moshe, you know, you can't do all this by yourself. You need other people to help you. And other people are appointed. Now, I will allow that one needs to understand the difference between those people that sound like judges and the people in this week's Parsha who are appointed. And I once gave a class that when we read about Moshe's description, his retrospective in Sefer Devarim, it actually sounds very much like he's combining the two episodes together. Nonetheless, the simple read that we have of this, which I think is the more normative read, is that Moshe already has people that are helping him. What happened to those people? Now, Rashi already, again, that's why you have to learn Rashi a little bit better and more carefully and connect the dots sometimes. Rashi, when he said katzek, read hamachaneh, he brought two possibilities. One was the heir of Rav, and the other possibility he brought was the tzinim. Now, who exactly are the tzinim? Now you take a look, and it says in Surah 17, Pirshim Menasya Biktsinim Vigdolim Shem Vehim Hasanhedrin Ulakachamer and so on Devarish Badova Dezu Sanhedrin. Now again, the Sanhedrin is very interesting because that's most likely a better description of who's about to be appointed. But I think what he really means is all the judges that Moshe has. What happened to all the leaders? So now you realize also why Moshe would have suddenly felt shot. Why he suddenly would have felt so isolated and so alone and suddenly feel this burden upon him. If the Ktzei HaMachaneh really means that all of the leaders are turned against Moshe, now Moshe turns to God and says, you know, what in the world have you done to me? I am all by myself here and all the leaders are working against me. And that would actually explain the isolation and the loneliness and the difficulty which he's facing. And as I said, Rashi understands that as a possibility of Pshat. And again, that's what Shmuel Ben Asa said, that no, all the Ktzinim are gone. All the leaders are gone, and now Moshe has this entire people upon him. Because the fire came and burnt them all up. That's what it says. The fire, again, maybe we needed to pay a little bit more attention to that. But if the two episodes are one episode, look back in Source 8, Pasuk Aleph, V'yi'am kimitoninim rabineas Hashem, V'yishma Hashem v'yicharapo, V'tiv'arbam eish Hashem, V'tuchal b'kitzei hamachaneh. And if Kitzei HaMachaneh means the leaders, that means that right now they're leaderless other than one leader, and that's Moshe. By the way, then you would say, but at least he's got his brother and his sister. Yeah? No, he doesn't. Which means, and Moshe, for his part, you know, takes this from them, and Moshe is just so modest and just, you know, such humility. And nonetheless, he's just completely alone. And that's why at this point he needs this new leadership to come in and to take the place of the old one. As I said, that reading just now became that much more interesting. It sounds that way. Oh, well, again, one can always say, if you go like in Shlach without the Meraglim, you can give the same interpretation. Maybe they felt they're the leaders in the desert, but once they move on, they're going to lose their jobs, and maybe that's why they hesitate. But also consider another thing. When Moshe takes the Jews out, there's actually one guy who may understand him, and that's Yisro. Why? Because Yisro is also a leader. So he's a leader, and he says, listen, leaders need to know how to delegate. So now think about what's happened in this week's Parsha. Assuming that Chobav and Yisro are the same person, he lost Yisro, the only one who can really give advice. He lost all the people that Yisro gave advice in order to take, and now Moshe's just standing there all by himself. So again, to get back to this point of where things are coming from and perhaps how difficult it is, think about that. The Sforno says the complaints were absolutely baseless. It's not that they needed food, they didn't need food. Because again, the critical analysis of all this is, what are they complaining about? There's nothing. So he actually says it. 19, kimit onanim, al Torah haderech, lo mit onanim bilibam, be'emet, ki lo ita etzlem, shum siba ru'ya lezeshit onanu, aval yumit onanim, bidivreihem lenasot. All they were doing is that they were picking on God because, and they had no reason. People have no reason at all to complain, and they look for something to complain about, but there really was no complaint whatsoever. There's a book, which I'm quoting here, called The Beit Yosef Lahava, of Yosef ben Tzvi. You see the year is 1792, 1846. So he actually makes a very interesting comment. You know, one of the, just to see where he gets it from, one of the things it says, V'ha'asavsuf asher b'kirbo hit'avu ta'ava. So he's troubled by what does the phrase hit'avu ta'ava mean? So he goes into this whole discussion that you are what you eat, and things that you eat can impact you. And as of this point, they're not eating meat, and they're not eating these other things. Again, if they eat meat, then it's a korban, it's a kudshim. They're not eating meat, they're not eating other things, they're only eating man. So if they're only eating man, they should theoretically have no yetzer hara whatsoever. There is this whole point, at which point the yetzer hara comes in, but I'm going to leave it, maybe connected to food as well. But he's saying is that there is nothing over here that should be causing them. So listen to what he writes. V'nei hamana shehum achal elyon vade eino molid ta'ava la'adam. Man descends from heaven, is spiritual stuff, should not cause a ta'ava. Av basar v'gam kol dvim asher amru heim molidim ta'ava. V'nei, they cause there to be a desire. V'nei masha olast, masha adam ochel b'ta'ava yesh to hana'a yotor mimasha ochel b'lo ta'ava. Something which is eaten with, you know, real desire is more satisfying than where there's less desire. V'nei asafsuf, heima eruv rav, hayu margishim t'chila shaman lo malid ta'ava. They're the eruv rav, and they were very troubled. Why are they troubled? Of course, the yetzer hara was not working well. Is they find themselves neutered in a certain sense. V'zeh sha'amar hit'avu ta'ava, shayu mit'avim sheyelahem ta'ava. Hit'avu ta'ava, they desired desire. They lusted after lust. So therefore, the problem is they don't have lust, which of course is a wonderful philosophical question. If you don't have lust, then how do you lust after lust? And where does this come from? But it seems that they feel an emptiness. The emptiness, what they feel is they don't feel they have enough of yetzer hara, and therefore they complain. And that complaint then ends up making inroads into the community as well. V'hayu yira'im shenif sakata v'tam mehem. Saying this, that they wanted. As I said, I find this fascinating, but I want to go back to what I think is, again, the larger issue. The Beit Yosef Lahava. Lahava. So I want to go back now and just go through what I think is taking place. I told you from the beginning, I think the issue over here is one of attitudes towards Kedusha. So we looked at Pesach Sheni, and maybe we have a group of people that absolutely want Kedusha, or maybe on the other hand, they're not representative of the entire people. They're a special group of people. Or maybe it's not Kedusha at all that they wanted. They just want to be a part of the people, which means it's national and it's not religious. So as I said, that I see as a question. As we move forward, we have at least one person, Chovav, rejecting going to the land of Israel. And now we can, in retrospect, ask ourselves, is he just one individual? Is that representative of others? When they leave Egypt, they are supposed to be on the way to the land of Israel. They make a stop by Mount Sinai. Now when they leave Sinai, how do you leave Sinai? Which means, do you leave Sinai with a great deal of excitement because you left Sinai, as the Yerushalmi says, like children running out of school, as the Ramban finesses it, because they're afraid of more mitzvot because they don't want any more Kedusha? Or would you leave Sinai with excitement because now we're about to go, you know, get on the plane and go the Nefesh B'Nefesh flight and go straight to the land of Israel and end up in Israel, which means what's going on over here? Is there excitement for the land of Israel? And then we read the difficult commentaries regarding the man. It's absurd that they're so obsessed with food at this point when this is extremely temporary. It's like really complaining about the food on the airplane. Come on. Okay, so you eat a couple meals on the airplane. Now you move on. You have enough to eat? Are you okay? Are you starving? Right? Then you move on. What are you talking about? And the stuff they're getting is coming directly from God, unless that's, of course, the problem. Could they have a korban? Yeah, they could have had a korban. They don't want something which is holy. They don't want this food from God. They don't want this feeling that God is taking care of them. And that puts Moshe in this incredible position. At the same time, now we understand this possibility that Moshe has lost his advisor and now he has lost all of his help. And now Moshe is absolutely all alone with no one else, with a bunch of people who are saying, we don't want holiness. We just don't want holiness. And Moshe wants like nothing more than to take him to the land of Israel at this point. And these people seem to be saying, no, we have no interest. We need long-term food solutions for us in the desert. And Moshe, no, the land of Israel. That's where we're going. And they're, no, not really that interested in that right now. And of course, they win, which means they lose. And they don't go to the land of Israel right away. And Moshe never ends up going there. And then you realize all the tragedy involved in this. And what could have been, so simple, leaving Har Sinai with excitement and happiness and joy, like the Ramban said, because now we're headed to the land of Israel. And instead, very, very quickly, the excitement is leaving Sinai. The excitement is not going to the land of Israel. Instead, what they have right now is suddenly a sense of heaviness, of difficulty, of anxiety. And, what are we going to eat? And what are we going to do? And, everything is terrible. And what are you talking about? God is leading you, taking care of you, protecting you. Really, God is taking care of you like this mother nursing their child and giving the food directly and carrying them in the desert. And they absolutely reject that. They don't want this. And this rejection of holiness is, of course, the rejection of God. And Moshe, our most holy person, stands there, is watching this. And Moshe, again, can't possibly understand this. And you realize how lonely Moshe must have felt at that particular point. This overwhelming loneliness that suddenly he's just all alone. Everybody has abandoned him, and everybody at the same time has abandoned holiness and questioned holiness. This, of course, pauses, gets us ready now for next week's parsha, where they're going to have a full attack on the land of Israel. But my point is, don't think that that happened in a vacuum. The beginning of the rejection of land of Israel was already over here. The seeds already planted. The rejection is already here. You just have to look a little bit beneath the surface, and then you realize that the words of Chovav, no, I'm not interested in going there. He may not have been the only one who felt that way. There may have been a lot of people who felt that way, all maybe perhaps for different reasons. But this entry land of Israel and eating the pork chops that they find in Yericho, so that's something which nobody apparently, again, they don't want to eat pork. I understand that. I respect that. But they don't want to go to the land of Israel. They don't want to Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. They don't want to go to this place which has so much holiness to that. This seems to be a rejection of holiness, which seems to be the core of what's taking place here.